SODA, which is School of Digital Arts at Manchester Met. So we're thrilled to have everybody here today. We're going to be talking about divas, of course. I'm going to just talk you through our book, how it came about, and a little bit about what's within it. So first of all, I'm just going to hand over to my colleagues who are going to introduce themselves. So Ben, let's start with you.
Thanks, Kirsten. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dr. Ben Halligan. I'm director of the Doctoral College at the University of Wolverhampton, and I'm very happy to be here today to talk about this book that has just been published in the last couple of weeks. But it arises from a conference that we convened at the University of Wolverhampton in 2019. And there were all kinds of ideas that I'm going to talk about in a bit, but I really wanted to open up conversations around and explore about what seemed to me not to be so much a new cultural phenomenon, but a certain culture that had entered the mainstream and become, in a way, the mainstream itself. So the diva figure is very much a figure for our time, dresses everybody, and that's why this is called Your. But I've worked a bit around popular music, and Kirsty and I, a few years back, co-edited a book on arena concerts. We were interested in mass entertainment at that point, and I work a bit in film history and critical theory and things like that as well.
Thank you. Let's move on to Shara.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Shara Rambaran, and I'm a senior lecturer in music business and media. I'm also the author of Virtual Music, Sound Image, and Music in the Digital Era, published by Bloomsbury, and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Music and Virtuality, and also the musicologist for Decode podcast for Spotify. For this session, I'll be giving you an insight on how Mariah Carey erases the misconceptions of the diva, and I'll explain more later, so thank you.
Thank you. And Harriet?
Hi, I'm Harriet Reid. I'm curator of contemporary performance here at the V&A, and this project kind of formed part of the early research for the Diva exhibition on here at the V&A Museum, which hopefully you've all seen. So I'll be talking a little bit about that. Also, just some housekeeping while I'm speaking. There are no fire drills planned today, so if you hear the fire alarm goes, that'll go off. Follow the instructions and I'll lead us out safely. And also, if you're planning on sticking around, because the museum's open till 10 o'clock this evening, we have a talk happening in the lecture theatre with my colleague curator Jacqueline Springer with Goldie. So that's at 6:30 p.m. So if you want to join us for that as well, please do. But yeah, I'll hand back to Kirsty.
Wonderful, thank you. And we have our colleague Nicole from Kansas, who should be on screen, or will be on screen in a moment.
Hello, everyone. I think it's afternoon there. It's 8:18 a.m. I'm coming to you from Kansas City. I'm Dr. Nicole Hodges-Persley. I'm a professor of American Studies and African-American Studies at the University of Kansas. And I think I'm the lone American as part of our editorial team. And I'll be talking to you today about my book chapter, which is called Simultaneously Black, and it's on the work of Drake and Nicki Minaj as cosmopolitan hip-hop artist. And I write pretty exclusively on hip-hop's influence on popular performance. I'm the author of Sampling and Remixing Blackness and Hip-Hop Theater and Performance, and also a recent publication on hip-hop and musical theater that's on Methuen as well. So delighted to be with you all this afternoon.
Thank you, Nicole. Let's go back to the slides. So I didn't say much about what I do. So, as Ben said, I've done a couple of books now, music documentary and arena concerts, also a book on music video. I also do lots of work on prints. I've got a couple of prints fans in the room today. I've written extensively on Prince, His Life and Legacy, and yes, I do think that he's a diva, so we can talk about that later. And my next book is on women in pop music documentaries, so very much about kind of screen cultures and music and how those two areas converge. So, as Ben mentioned then, the book project evolved from the 2019 conference, Diva, Hip Hop, Feminism and Fierceness, which was convened by Ben and held at the University of Wolverhampton. And we had a great response to that conference, and it was a really rich discussion of all different, so many different facets of the notion of the diva. And we also had a wonderful photographer and artist and director, Hoga Caesar, who screened his Aaliyah documentary, which isn't shown very often, is it, Ben? I don't think it's shown
hardly
very often at all, is it? So it was a real treat to have that screened at the conference. So that's kind of how the book evolved and where it came from. We're really going to hear, obviously, today from the speakers who were there. So the book then addresses the diva phenomenon and its origins. So what is the diva? What does it mean in popular culture? What does it mean now? What has it meant historically? How has the concept of the diva shifted? And that's particularly as it relates to identity politics, to its LGBTQ plus components, its creativity and its influence in and beyond music. So we really touch upon so many different areas within the book. We have something, we have a chapter, for example, on the diva as it relates to stand-up comedy. And theatre, we have the divas that you would expect in the book. So as you can see there, Beyoncé, Whitney, Grace Jones, Dolly Parton. So those artists that we associate often with the notion of the diva. But it's how much it's shifted. What it really means now in popular culture is what we're particularly interested in. So the kind of its forms, its functions, and its kind of blurry and fuzzy edges. So I'm going to hand over now to Ben, who's going to talk a little bit about his chapter and a little bit more about how the whole concept evolves. So Ben, here are you staying there?
Sorry, I was looking at books. We'll be finishing at 3:30, the original list is at 5, so we'll be finishing at 8.
Thanks so much, Kirsty. And indeed, we'll have a bit of Q&A, a bit of discussion at the end. So if there's anything you want to come back to or share your thoughts on, we would really welcome that. So I want to talk a little bit about just some of the ideas that are in my particular chapter in Diva that's called Aaliyah's Voice and After. Let me just get to the slide. Here we go. Aaliyah, I think, is a very important figure in terms of this transition that I think seemed to occur around the year 2000 into the mainstream. Aaliyah seemed to be the figure that took hip-hop and R&B from the margins into, as it were, the most popular, evolving, dynamic area of American popular music at that time. But her work had kind of slightly been lost in a way. She was born in 1979 and died in terrible circumstances that remain somewhat mysterious in 2001. And her work since then hasn't been particularly available, at least until the last year or so. One thing that was terribly interesting for me about Aaliyah is that she starts with Age Ain't Nothing But a Number, which you see here at the top right-hand corner. So she starts as a teenager, singing about teenage girl things, sort of intimacy, dreams, hope, fantasies. But she ends as the diva. So we have that trajectory in her particular work, from the young person in the bedroom dreaming of her future to the global superstar. But one of the challenges in terms of writing about that is subsequent revelations that were tied to Me Too and tied to the way in which there was, as it were, an expose of abusive relationship she'd been in and some of the terrible things that clearly she'd been through that began to explain the 20 years of silence, I think, after her death, and began to explain as well the ambiguities as to why she wasn't celebrated, I think, as a very important diva. In respect of Me Too and thinking about her work that you see displayed here, it wasn't just the idea that here was a wonderful artist, but was subject to abuse. It was that, unfortunately, some of these albums seemed to have been the methods of abuse for her, seemed to have been the way in which she was groomed and the way in which she was exploited. At the same time, I think Me Too posed a challenge to academics, writers, and critics, which was how do we deal with this problematic, tainted material? And it reminded me of a song called Four Page Letter by Aaliyah, which begins with her speaking directly like an MC, like she's DJing in a club. And she says, yo, turn my music up. Up some more. Up a little bit more. And I thought, in a way, And this is perhaps the project behind this book, Diva. The task was to try and amplify, try and rescue those voices, explore the creativity despite the Me Too contextualization of her life and her work, and to turn the voice up, turn the music back up, which is what I was attempting to do in this chapter. In thinking about her music and her work with Timbaland, what seemed to me to be very striking was the absolute maximal nature of the work, that this incredible, enveloping, all-engulfing voice. A lot of divas, I'm thinking Sade, Desiree, sometimes the voice is isolated in the mix. You can imagine when you listen to it, the solo singer, but not so much with Aaliyah. The voice is everywhere, at all points at once. It's almost the voice of God. Thinking about analogies, it's almost like Gregorian chant. The way the Gregorian chant is amplified and echoes across the monastery, the stone of within the church, or so forth. And this was the kind of mixing of Aaliyah. So that when her voice sings, it is something that kind of knocks you back, like listening almost to an opera singer. And when the voice suddenly stops at the end of various songs, Four-Page Letter, More Than a Woman, you really get a sense that she has left the stage. And in a way, those songs, I guess, terribly anticipate the premature exit of Aaliyah. I was thinking too about divas of this moment and what happens to them, because of course the music industry is terribly cruel, but particularly in terms of R&B and hip hop. And what is the afterlife of some of these figures? And there were two that I really wanted to talk about, because in a way, the afterlife can seem to return them from the global superstar diva, the Beyoncé template, to somebody that maybe forges a different relationship with you. And I think if you listen to their music when you were younger, you maintain that contact. So it's quite exciting that suddenly the diva is in your hometown. Here's Amory, who was active with these albums 2002 to 2009. I guess could have been the next Beyoncé, but it kind of wasn't to be. So she had a run of, I think, really fantastic albums. I saw her live, there's a photo there in 2015 with a full-on rock group. She's got this slightly grungy shirt and these sort of leather hot pants, and she was really rocking out, and it was just fantastic. But beyond that, she seemed to take on an interesting new role, which is emceeing. And this is seeing her again in 2017 in a really ghastly club. I'm glad it's shut, called the Milton Club in Manchester. It's the kind of thing where they ask you to declare your salary before they allow you to be a member, full of like estate agents. And this was round the corner for me, so I thought, great, I go and see Anne-Marie. And here she was emceeing in the club, singing over basically a laptop, playing her music. And it was very interesting because there was a huge amount of interaction with the audience. There was call and response, holding the hands of those present while she was singing, high-fiving, very much in the midst of the attendees in the nightclub, singing directly to them, at them, with them, for them. This in itself speaks to the fragmentation, I think, of popular culture from 2000 onwards, whereby it's no longer just about buying the album, collecting the album, maybe seeing the gig. But the gig is configured in another way. The concert becomes the most important thing. The album is almost like a free add-on that you can download and not pay for. But more than that, as with the ill-fated Fyre Festival, these are figures that distinguish what it means to go to a nightclub. Hey, I went to a nightclub and I saw Anne-Marie. Do you remember her? That song, One Thing? Yeah, we chatted. She said hi and that kind of thing. So suddenly the diva is down from this international role and is hanging out, and you can get in touch with them and you can contact them. It's the same with Ashanti, who also, I guess, was somebody from that particular era and is still around. And this is a live feed from a nightclub DJ event. So in a way, democratically, and I take a lot of, I think this is a totally good thing, the trajectory seems to be from bedroom to superstar and then back to nightclub and into our environs. When Kirsty and I were pushing the arena concert book together, one of the questions we were grappling with was this idea of intimacy and how technology in about the year 2000, with huge video screens, allowed you to go to a massive arena to see the Spice Girls, to have that moment with them, but kind of not really. You were miles away. There were tiny little dots at the other end of the building. How do you create intimacy was really one of the big issues. Because often divas, you know, they sing about stuff that should be common to all of us. They universalize these things. And you can't do that so much if you're a superstar, and yet you need to be a superstar to do this in a way that gains all this traction. So there's an interesting contradiction there. And I wondered if in the example Zamarie, in the example of Ashanti, you had the kind of closing of that particular thing and the beginning of a new culture aligned to new social media technologies. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. We have Nicole, who's going to speak next.
That's great. I think the exciting part that you'll see as we talk today, that this is such an exciting group of scholars, and I was very excited to be a part of this, of curating this book. And so I'll talk a little bit about my piece, which is on Nicki Minaj and Drake. And you know, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone for being here. And I come to this book as an artist scholar. I'm a theater director, and I do short form films. And my work as an artist scholar really informs the process for me of making a book chapter. I call myself an accidental academic because I'm an artist coming to the work with questions as an artist. And so my work on hip hop is really about opening up new conversations. And this is a great time to be talking about diva culture. We're in, you know, hip hop and its intersection with diva culture is not something I think is really the work of, you know, of Kirstie and Ben, of thinking, what is this moment and why this book now? And so diva culture, the work of being a diva, it really has a great kinship with hip hop. And so this is, you know, the 50th anniversary, and we're seeing hip hop celebrations all across the world. But, you know, hip hop is, squarely coming out of social and cultural circumstances of unrest, of deindustrialization in the United States in the early 1970s. And I think it's important to know, as we enjoy and express and analyze the music and culture of hip hop, that we don't forget the people that make it and why they need this music, why we need hip hop to answer critical questions or to make these interrogations. So as we think about hip hop being celebrated around the world, are we still engaging the social, cultural, political cadences that allow Black, Brown, and as we move across hip hop's influence to influence multiracial, national, ethnic, religious positionalities, abilities, capacities around the world? I think that inspired me to think about what does it mean to be hip hop and Black in this moment, and how is Blackness something that is a commodity of hip hop that continues to be transferred and explored, not in a just commodified way, but in a way that allows people to think about new forms of citizenship, liberation, and to challenge our notions of what cosmopolitanism is. So my piece is called Simultaneously Black, Drake and Nicki Minaj at the Performance of Hip Hop Cosmopolitanisms. And what I'm doing in this piece is really thinking about the ways that hip hop wasn't always read as this kind of glamorous diva space. It really has these kind of false tropes and that continue to be negatively recircled in ways that can harm and hurt people. And I think if we think about the work of Drake and Nicki Minaj, the piece really seeks to map the influence, not only their individual influences on the music and culture and the simultaneity of their identities as artists who are read as at once African-American and at once Canadian in the sense of Drake, at once Trinidadian in the case of Nicki Minaj, and thinking about how these artists map the influence of hip hop music and culture on not only onto their bodies, but as they weave it into their work. And they do particular types of very sophisticated diplomacy as they bring people across borders not only with their identities, but with the ways that their work is distributed and also created by them as artists. And so one of the questions that I think in this piece that is really helpful for me and that I wanted to explore is the ways that artists themselves have critical questions that they're exploring. And so why do we only look at the work as product? Why do we not necessarily give the opportunity for the artist to be read as a social and cultural critic who is constantly curating not only the image of themselves, but the image of the world that they would like to participate in? And so the theatrical part of the work of Drake and Nicki Minaj is not only their critical artistry, but it's also the possibility making that their work enables. So by placing diva culture in conversation with hip hop, not as just a music aesthetic and genre, but as an identity formation matrix, as a site of identity remix, I think this is very exciting. And this is really the scope of my work, kind of across books, is able to kind of think about how can we take the work of artists and open up opportunities, not just to analyze it, but to reveal what the artists themselves are analyzing about the work. So I really try to look at the ways that hip hop is a cosmopolitan site of world making and cultural production, not only as music and aesthetic, but also the performances themselves are offering opportunities for us as listeners and as feelers of the music, because it's a visceral experience for us. It brings joy, it brings sorrow, it brings confusion, it brings opportunities to us to rage and explore our own critical questions. In this piece, one of the things I'm asking is, you know, why do we need certain tropes to persist? And so there's these false binaries within hip hop culture that really elevate these hood tropes as a point of departure and a way, it really is a place that many artists have to really prove their rite of passage and having some connection to their location of the hood. And that can be fictional, or that can be something that is really coming out of a lived experiences. And it almost really is an experience that forecloses the work to also be read as cosmopolitan. And so I really want to unsettle those type of binaries that persist in our analysis and engagement with hip hop culture. And I discuss how Drake and Minaj really unsettle these lazy projections by the entertainment industry and how their work subverts the making of hip-hop's blackness as really deliberately subversive, not only in what non-black consumers and lovers of the music and culture can experience, but also the taking on and discarding the parts of their identities that are no longer useful to them in the process of them really becoming who they are over the course of their work. And so I think what's useful for us to think about this in relationship to the curatorial process of the bookmaking is that many of the artists that I offered to the group of editors here for consideration are, many of them are artist scholars that are working simultaneously as navigating their citizenship, but also navigating their identities being conflated with the work that they do. So there is some performative process of the authors. I'm thinking of Tamia Hearn Roy's piece on Janelle Monáe, or Rachel Blackburn's piece on black feminist stand-up comedians. All of the artists that I bring to the volume has been part of the curatorial process are also grappling with similar questions in their work, and they all really dovetail with work in hip hop and popular culture. So.
Thank you very much, Nicole. Thank you. Shamra.
Okay, so going on from all the conversations we've had so far, what we find with many divas in popular music is that most of these remarkable artists have a story and history, or indeed her story. These divas come from humble beginnings, challenging backgrounds, and have grafted to reach their dreams and continue to be ambitious and admirable and contribute to society and cultures. Early examples who would have been argued as popular divas in the last century, May Queen, Marie Louis from the Victorian musical era, the pop singer Dusty Springfield, and can even go across the world with Fayouz from Lebanon, Maria Callas from Greece, Teresa Teng from Taiwan, and of course Josephine Baker from the United States, who relocated to Paris. These fascinating and talented artists have all had a story to tell. Keeping that momentum, the divas that we've heard so far in this conversation today, I had the pleasure in reading and editing an amazing set of chapters for this volume. I also produced a chapter for a section in our volume called Rise to Power. And this section, in general, includes discussions of divas such as Dolly Parton, Whitney Houston, and Grace Jones. And they all have fascinating stories, including their rise to power. So in this section, I focus on Mariah Carey with a chapter called Proceed with Caution. Mariah Carey, the ultimate diva in popular music and culture, with a question mark. I'll just give you a flavour of the chapter, because I do think she's a great example of a diva in contemporary era who rose to stardom and continues to do so. And she came from a very humble background and faced challenges throughout her life. And she was raised by a single parent, and you know, she came from a multiracial background as well. And in her teens, she really worked hard to make it in the industry as a singer and songwriter. And once she found her moment, with her debut single, Visions of Love, in 1999, it was noted that her performances, such as the MTV Unplugged, where she exuded confidence and, you know, maintained presence in the media and, of course, MTV. And yes, it was during the 1990s when she was scoring hit after hit with Dream Lover, Hero, and so on. As we hit the 2000s, we start to witness a mature, but yet a playful Mariah Carey, who, mainly by the media, portrayed her as a diva in a negative sense. You know, the common associations that we may have with that term, you know, that they may be demanding, difficult to work with, and so on, rather than focusing on them as a diva, as a musical artist, and in this case, a remarkable singer and songwriter. So, but Mariah Carey goes beyond that. So in this chapter, I argue how Mariah Carey can be misunderstood with thanks to the media, especially to those unfamiliar with her and her early music career. So while she is a remarkable and compelling performer, musician, she knows how to handle her critics, she can hold her own, and you know, what we tend to see is what's on surface, that is her mask, her persona, and her infamous antics. But behind all of that, you know, she's had a difficult marriage, she was in a controlling relationship, and she's constantly facing criticism for her multiracial identity. Also, what tends to be unnoticed with Mariah Carey, especially if you're unfamiliar with her works, that is she's a remarkable songwriter and a music producer as well, and she does a lot of work for charity and supports a lot of causes. So with that in mind, Mariah erases the misconceptions of the diva by just going along with it. Furthermore, she doesn't disappoint us. She showcases all sides of the diva. That is, the diva as a celebrated singer, the diva as the theatrical, playful and drama queen, and the diva as an inspirational and powerful woman. So in my chapter, I do an audio visual reading of one of her songs called Obsessed, which was rumoured to be a dig at the hip-hop artist Eminem. But when you listen to the song, it does carry themes of harassment as well. In the music video in particular, Mariah Carey showcases the diva sides, all the super sides of her, that is the remarkable diva as the singer, the practical diva where she's posing for the camera and the classic wind blowing in her hair, and finally the powerful and inspirational diva who is advocating for women. So, all in all the other divas, you know, there are so many, okay, so many divas have been misunderstood, and you know, the likes of Whitney Houston, Lauryn Hill, and so on. You know, these divas are not always celebrated for their artistry and their artistic and music integrity, identity, and values. And these are the constant themes and arguments throughout the book. But of course, in the contemporary era of the diva, we can apply the term diva to other cultures and not just music. So on that note, I'd like to hand
you over to Harriet. Thank you, Shara. So as I mentioned earlier in the intros, I was sort of an early research assistant for the Diva exhibition. So when the conference was held in 2019, I was there. I wasn't allowed to say anything about the exhibition while it was in the planning stages, so I was almost like a spy, you know, learning so much from all of your research, presenting a little bit about the V&A itself. And it's been such a long journey to get to this point, and it's so incredible how it sort of dovetails with the publication as well. So thank you again for all coming. It's a special afternoon. And I also want to name the exhibition curators. So while I was part of that early research process, this exhibition was curated by Kate Bailey, senior curator, and co-curated by Veronica Castro, who sadly can't be here today. But a little bit about the show, if you haven't already seen it, hopefully you have. The exhibition is a journey that traces the story of the diva from the 19th century opera singer to the global megastar. It's cross-disciplinary, it's multi-sensory, and it's really about revealing how women, power and creativity have intersected and developed through the prism of performance. Although I should say there's not just women in there. It reveals how the diva finds her voice across performance genres and through social, technical and political change. How they reveal and reflect changing perceptions and attitudes to gender and femininity in particular. It celebrates the iconic attributes of a diva and includes a range of performers from across the performing arts, so drama or theatre, film, rock, pop and opera. And it's split into two sections, Act 1 and Act 2. So Act 1 introduces the diva in six scenes, as it were, from the 1820s to the 1960s. And this is really about the creation of the diva. So the sections cover early opera prima donnas like Adelina Patti, the Victorian drama queens, we mentioned Marie Lloyd, showgirls and dancers, the Hollywood actress from silent films such as Carol Lombard and Mary Pickford to Hollywood divas. There's a particularly amazing case with Joan Crawford and Betty Davis in it together, which is a little private joke. Well, not private, but a joke between creators. And the famous opera stars as well, like Maria Callas. And then Act Two, which is upstairs, looks at the 1960s to the present and redefining the diva. So thematically, there are sections on status, power and freedom, liberating the diva, voices for change, looking at the private and the public, rebellious reinvention, and the kind of glorious live performance of the diva. And I won't spoil it if you haven't seen it, but there's also a wonderful AV moment that kind of draws constellations between all of the performers, which you'll enjoy. So I hope that you'll recognize some of the clothing there and the performers associated with it. But the greatest thing, I guess, about the show was the way that the kind of collaboration came about with the book and the exhibition. It's a funny thing sometimes working in museums, you just sort of hit upon the zeitgeist, and when I saw this conference was happening, I thought it's really bizarre that we're both on this trajectory, and it's so important that, you know, museums and academia work together on this to really kind of reinforce the scholarship behind what we display and what's written. But alongside the exhibition research, this also fed into my own interest, which is curating performance itself. And as can be seen in the exhibition, you can really trace the history of the Diva throughout the whole V&A collection, from its kind of origins in classical sculptures to costumes worn by drag performers. And beyond the collections, I was also really interested in the wider institutional role. And this is what my chapter focuses on as well. Museums occupying space as almost quasi-religious sites, which are complicit in the worship of the Diva by both displaying their celebrity and becoming a site of pilgrimage for fans. I don't know how many Rihanna fans are coming just to gaze upon her wondrous costumes. And by association as well, so the display of those objects are then imbued with the same sort of sacred-like quality. And particularly at the V&A, the music exhibition or the pop culture exhibition has now been sort of accepted as an integral part of our portfolio. And that wasn't always the case. But it always has the aim to kind of educate and entertain, but it holds a deep emotional and often spiritual meaning for visitors. And I think arguably more so than any other subject genre that we explore in our shows. Music uniquely creates a sense of memory, identity, and place. And within the nuanced contextual display of celebrity artifacts, it assumes a powerful aura through the lens of the visitor. So in the chapter, I looked at three previous exhibitions at the V&A and how these have sort of transformed our concept of the Diva. So at the 2019 conference, this was me sort of tailoring or exploring these concepts while we were developing the eventual show. So we've got Kylie, the exhibition from 2007, the Supremes from the Mary Wilson collection of 2008, and the House of Annie Lennox, which was 2011. And while these exhibitions did not intend to present the artists as divas, they provide a compelling framework for an examination of the female performer within a museum context. Kylie could be said to be a somewhat surface-level show, but it did reveal the extraordinary hard work behind her image. The Supremes praise the female performers within their social and political context, so went beyond the kind of monographic style and expanded its content to bring in the then contemporary artists, which were Destiny's Child, very 2008 there. And Annie Lennox was an experimental and process-driven installation which combined objects with performance art, and that was a much more collaborative process, working with Lennox on her being present in the space at certain times. So all three exhibitions are vastly different in their concepts, and yet all speak to both 19th century and contemporary ideas of the Diva, which I go into more detail in the chapter, and have acquired further significance in light of the hugely successful exhibition we have on now. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just to say, we have a flyer for 35% off the book, so if you're interested, it's published by Bloomsbury, by the way, I didn't say that earlier. We have those available if you're interested in purchasing a copy. So I think we've got time now for some questions, if anyone has any.
What do we think, I'm going to Madonna on Sunday, what do we think about the vilification of the older Diva and still in 2023?
To me. Gosh, that's such a good question. And I wonder if that concert will...
Yeah, so what do you think about the vilification of Madonna as the older Diva in 2023, which has been going on for a long time now, hasn't it? And she's been... it's really interesting to see kind of her trajectory and how she's responding or not, what someone said to it.
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I wonder if the concert will begin to sketch out answers to that question, because one thing that I think has typified a lot of popular music over the last 20 years has, you know, been the reformation of groups, people back together who start releasing albums, and it's as if they've never gone away. And I think there's a demographic of people that would now go to gigs, whose maybe their parents would have stopped going to gigs at a certain age, and it's no longer what you do. But now it's all ages, it's all demographics. And these stars of yesteryear who are still particularly relevant, particularly in our psyche, I think, are still there. And it raises these questions because, you know, we live in a very ageist culture. And I mean, Kirsty, you're involved in celebrity studies, and ageism is a major theme.
Ageism and celebrity studies is something that, you know, since the inception of celebrity studies, ageism is an area that's been focused on. I think it feels like, you know, we've happened on a studies, haven't we? For that was a long time ago. It does feel like maybe that's the next conference. Maybe she needs to be looked at again, because I think there's so much that, you know, she's such a rich text in herself in terms of, you know, not just ageism, but notions of beauty and, you know, feminism, of course. Yeah, I think she's a really interesting area of study. I think there's a lot to be said about where Madonna is right now, actually. I don't know, Nicole, do you have any thoughts on Madonna and ageism?
Well, I do. I think, you know, we can look, I think all roads lead back to Madonna. in a lot of different ways, whether we, particularly, you know, in relationship to hip hop and to beauty culture, to, you know, sexual fluidity and questioning the gender, you know, binary in the 80s, embracing the ballroom culture. I mean, I thought it very striking during the Beyonce tour that there was not a really proper citation of Madonna. Whether it's really questioning her commodification of ballroom or and the ways that she, you know, was provoked a lot in the late 80s from cultural appropriation. I think, you know, if you look at many of the popular, you know, millennial, not, I would say more Gen X divas that are coming out of that generation, there's a generational citation of, you know, work from Madonna. Whether it be provocation and the grading of coffee table books to challenging the Catholic Church, I think that she was a provocateur. And I think because her beauty was a passport for a lot of this work, I think as she loses that commodity, right, she's no longer useful in a lot of different ways to the current kind of perpetual youth culture that we're in right now. And that's really like for all women, really. It's like if you're not using Botox, if you're not keeping up your beauty bargain, then somehow you're not valuable. So I really appreciate that about Harriet's really historization of the diva over time, so we can kind of echo, look at the reverberations of, could this hold up now? And obviously I think this, the kind of vitriol around Madonna right now, you know, it's worthy of a conference, worthy of another book, so maybe this question is plenty of seed for invitation.
Thank you. Shara, Harriet, have you got any thoughts on Madonna?
I get one thing that jumped into my mind was the criticism of Glastonbury this year for having no female headliners, or saying Lizzo was a kind of co-headliner, and that the majority of these kind of heritage acts are male, or they're rock bands. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like Madonna is singled out as being the only woman. How does she have the audacity to keep performing at her age when you have Mick Jagger still having children? And I there's definitely sexism embedded into it, but I don't think we've also had this yet in the 20th century. I can't think of any other woman who was that successful and that impactful culturally who is still performing to the level that they think they want to be and should be. Yeah, and therefore, sorry?
Diana Ross. Maybe she's not as controversial.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's a certain, I guess it's Madonna behaving as she would 20, 30 years ago is the difference, whereas I suppose Diana has kind of reconciled herself to her kind of older statesman position. I don't know, that's a rude word to use about Diana Ross. Legend status. But yeah, that's just what I had.
It's only one Madonna. I'm a big Madonna fan. She's the queen of meta-modernism. She always stays fresh, always stays relevant, and I will be very interested to see, you know,
what she does in her concerts as well, and I'm very excited to see that as well. But yeah, very good points raised here, you know. I can't really think of a new Madonna. Of course, it's been imitations. Once upon a time, it's like, oh, Lady Gaga, right? So, you know, but Madonna still tries to continue to stay fresh and relevant, and yeah, see where this goes.
Absolutely. Any other questions at all? Thank you, Matt. Yes.
Mine kind of segues a bit. Like, who would you say are the emergent divas in the industry now, and how do you see the diva evolving for the next generation?
Good question.
Do we repeat it? Do you want to?
No, that's kind of segueing into what my question was going to be about.
So, who are the emergent divas, and what was the first part of the question, sorry?
Yeah, who would you say are emergent divas,
yeah,
and how do you see
the diva evolving?
I mean, I guess in the exhibition we have people like Billie Eilish, Janelle Monáe. I guess you still have. It's tricky because we talked about that a lot as well. But it's so hard to predict the trajectory of someone and their career and how long or how influential it will be, especially when you're planning a show 2-3 years.
Yeah,
Lizzo.
Yeah, controversial figure.
Yeah. I think that there are some we picked out in the show, but you guys will probably have better suggestions.
Mm. Nicole, do you have any thoughts on who the next generation might be?
Well, I think we're witnessing it. You know, I think if we take Taylor Swift and Beyonce, definitely constructing an alliance with one another and informing one another, and Taylor giving, you know, props, if you will, to Beyonce for being there for her in career. If we even go back to the I'm gonna let you finish, but with Kanye West interrupting, you know, Taylor's VMA, oh, I think it was VMA award. So I think us fighting against ageism means allowing the artists to age, and so I think the Beyonce of Destiny's Child and the mature artist that we're seeing come, you know, into her own now, there's another evolution. So, well, you know, in 10 years when Beyonce is 50, like, we've given her permission to be 40 because she's performed 40 in a way that is still acceptable, right? And the beauty factor, similarly, you know, we're watching Taylor come of age. You know, she's been performing since she was a teenager. So I think there is now some referential aesthetic adjustments that are being made for people to figure out, hey, this didn't go well for Madonna. Again, Madonna's coming back up. But how can we do this, you know, and try to protect ourselves against the sexism that's embedded in the industry? So, I mean, I feel like they are emergent folks that I see. I agree with Eilish. You know, we're watching Taylor when she brought in, you know, Spice, you know, to be on the tour. But again, Harriet's longevity discussion, like, how much patience or time do we have to grow with an artist anymore? And both those artists moved with us from the analog to the digital. You know, they had that crossover component to, you know, being in the moment where we were just converting to a, like, all digital culture. So, time will tell, but I think Gaga still, you know, but I don't know if we have patience in social media right now to keep our attention on anyone for as long as we have with these artists.
That's a very good point. Thank you. Ben?
Yeah, I actually have a surprising answer to that question, which is from the introduction to our Diva book. And it's from a discussion about whether the term diva is positive or negative, whether it's a compliment or pejorative. And we wondered if diva was a certain quality, a certain way of being in the world, a certain way of presenting yourself, which doesn't necessarily have to mean within popular music. So there's a quote here from a newspaper article. Meghan Markle used the word diva of Mariah Carey, and Mariah replied that Meghan had her own diva moments. It stopped me in my tracks. When she called me a diva, Markle said with great urgency. And you can almost hear her leaning forward. I started to sweat a bit. I started squirming my chair in this quiet revolt. Why would you say that? My mind was spinning with what nonsense she had read or clicked on that made her think that about me. Okay, so clearly Mariah Carey thinks the word of the word as positive or neutral, while Meghan Markle thinks of it as pejorative. But I think in terms of Meghan Markle, she clearly has some of those paradigm-breaking qualities, the ability to be an event in herself, to be within the middle of the establishment, to speak of a certain intersectional experience, to bring in other voices, to reassemble things in a way that perhaps haven't been done before, and to attract fierce, racialized criticism. So I think Meghan Markle is my answer to your excellent question.
Yes.
To lead on to that, because I was thinking about the same thing in my head, I was thinking to an artist such as FKA Twigs, and she's a rising star. I think that she's phenomenal as an artist.
Yes,
in dance, performance, she's just artistic across all of it. And how she performed at Paris Fashion Week was just out of this world recently. And I do think we haven't heard enough of her voice, and I think her speaking out, and I know that this trial that apparently is going to go ahead next year will probably push her up into that as a new figurehead, another kind of Me Too moment of her speaking out against an abusive relationship. But I wonder from that, how much of being considered a diva is connected to being controversial and, the activist element of it. Mm-hmm. Is it enough to be just an amazing performer and a true artist such as FKA Twigs if you don't have the aspect of taking the stand to something? Mm-hmm. I was so inspiring seeing all of every different artist, was really speaking out about different injustices and really going the path less travelled, which was lovely to see and inspiring. But I wondered how much that thread kept coming up between all of them.
Mm. And also activism, isn't it also born out of struggle as well?
Mm.
Isn't that kind of one of the major trajectories and kind of paths that we see the divas emerge from? The idea that they've had lived difficult early lives and kind of risen from that through to due to their excellence and talent. I think something about that, but the activism question I think is really an important one as well. I don't know, Sharon. Anyone want to respond to that?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, and that was something that was definitely integrated into the narrative of the exhibition, that they had to have some form of owning their voice or triumphing over adversity, giving a voice to others, particularly with the line to feminism. And I agree, FKA Twigs is definitely a diva. I don't think she's in the exhibition, but she should be.
I've heard about her as well, so I think they'd be very, yeah, absolutely.
I think as well, it's something about the transition from third to fourth wave feminism, where, if you've been empowered in a certain way, you have to be empowered to do something, to say something. So it's great that there's so much outspoken divaisms. But at the same time, there's a chapter in the book about Jennifer Lopez, Shakira at the Super Bowl. And just in performing, just in being themselves, non-white performers, that in itself receives such a backlash that it is as if merely by walking into the room it brings a kind of activism, a kind of presence which throws into relief and calls into question a number of norms. So I think within the very best of fourth wave politics and the very best of third wave politics associated with feminism, you have a new form of activism, what it actually means to be inclusive, to live an inclusive culture and to be part of it. So the politics itself is changing, is nebulous, is something that I think we're still grappling with. I'd like to think that's a quality of upcoming generations of divas.
Thank you. Nicole?
I couldn't hear it was tough to hear, but I'm putting it together a little bit through your responses.
It was about deeds and activism, whether activism is a kind of key part of deedism.
I mean, I hope it is, and I think I definitely agree with Ben, is that, you know, for women of color, you know, the idea, the expectation that to make demands or to assert yourself within space that is, you know, rendered as, you know, normatively white or universal, it's, you know, this expectation that there's extra labor to do this work, you know, and I think, you know, Mariah's work, Janelle, you know, they're perceived as audacious to be able to make such demands, whether it be the demands for excellence of their teams or to demand the same as, you know, a woman who possesses whiteness and has that expectation that she will, or he, or they will be treated in a particular way or have an expectation of respect. And so I think there's been, it's definitely explicit for global majority artists to, you know, assert these demands. And I agree with the fourth wave component when you think about Meg the Stallion and others who, they can build on the work of a Beyonce and see the claims that an artist like this has made for herself and say, oh, that's the now the new baseline expectation for what I can ask for. And so I'm hoping that what we've seen that is possible when it will inspire a new generation of artists to say, hey, it's okay for me to stand up for myself. It's okay for me to say, absolutely not. It's okay for me to not fear a penalty for doing this. And I think earlier career divas, you notice still Beyonce's political assertions don't come, you know, as direct until probably Lemonade, where we see her the most, her Super Bowl performance is a very, you know, deliberately political act, and I would say, you know, similar with Gina Sandy Diaz's piece that Ben referenced on Shakira and J.Lo. The penalty is not just because of their, you know, their Latinx identities, it's because you don't have a right to be here, and now you're asserting yourself as if you do. And so that's a difficult coupling all the time to have to battle. You know, to always feel like you have to be responsible for starting the fire, but I think it's just part of the job.
Thank you very much. Have we got any time left, Harriet, for one more question?
Yeah.
So I think it's a continuation. I think you're right. I think social media is going to be the kind of deciding factor going forwards when you have what to me look like children, but these are the women of now as these activists, and Taylor Swift, who comes in underneath Beyonce but has somewhere in the region of 274 million social media followers, and a US government that is watching anxiously with every positioning statement she takes, and her followers are just moving behind her and seeking that influence as a guide to what they should be considering. And I think this is, you know, a staggering tool and a huge responsibility for these women to take that forwards, and to, it's just gonna get more and more powerful.
And it took her a long time to wade in, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
Because I read a recent interview with Dolly Parton, who's still refuses to express any kind of political opinion. The Guardian journalist really tried to push her on abortion rights in Tennessee, and she still wouldn't say. She said she had her personal views, but she wouldn't fall. And that's a particularly country music sort of question as well, because of the kind of hardcore fan base, particularly with Republican supporters. But yeah, that really was a important moment when she kind of expressed her support for the Democratic Party.
I very much agree with what you say, and it's an interesting historical moment, and perhaps it takes us back to 50 years, you know, when people like John Lennon had files on them, when youth was in revolt, time of borders, of migrants, people telling us multiculturalism is over or doesn't exist, or that your political opinions are politically correct to inane levels. I mean, we have culture back at the forefront, empowered, enabled, and yeah, it has the kind of effect and reach that you talk about. So I wonder if, in terms of the question about who are the divas going forward, whether those people will carry this mantle, are they going to be equipped, are they going to lead the fight, what kind of political formation will occur from this. And for me, I mean, in particular, in terms of, you know, thinking about intersectional ideas, to what extent are they going to be able to communicate what it means to be an outsider, modes of oppression, the fight, having to represent a certain strata of people, what it means to sort of, as you said, Dolly Parton, to say yes or no, to decline or to accept modes of questioning. So I think that the diva culture should perhaps begin to provide those answers, taking us into the next phase of popular music.
Brilliant, thank you very much. So thank you again, everyone, for coming along. Oh, do you have one more?
Just one quick last one. Yes. Your inclusion of Prince and Freddie Mercury was lovely to see. I didn't know if he was in there, Bowie was in there as well, but I did see him. But I just wondered, could you speak on that a little bit, and where you wanted to include people or leave people out? Or
There were many, many, many discussions about who qualified and who didn't. There was at one point a matrix that was devised, a kind of organogram, yes, no, style.
I want to see that.
Yeah. Which one of the questions was, have they, used kind of activism or their voice for any kind of political cultural change? That was an important point. But yeah, there was a debate about should men be in there, and we thought absolutely yes, because the attributes are beyond gender. We also have people like Sophie in there as well, so non-binary, you know, the whole full spectrum is included, because the diva itself has kind of become its own thing, its own moniker, its own persona that can be worn by anyone. And also, you can't not include Elton John. I mean, there was just no way we couldn't put Elton John in there. But yeah, that's, if you want any more information on the exhibition itself, if you email V&A, and I'll pass anything on to the lead curator as well, because I feel like I'm speaking for her as well, and she'll be more than happy to talk to you more about it.
That's great, thank you. So thanks again, everyone, for coming along. Hope you've enjoyed. And yes, as I've said, we do have some discount price if you're interested in the book. So thanks very much.